Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who examines allegations of Russian hacking in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, and the contradictory and troubling signals sent by Donald Trump about how he'll steer America's foreign policy. Historian, author, and activist Jeremy Brecker, who talks about his recent article titled Social Self-Defense, Protecting People and Planet Against Trump and Trumpism. And Paul Gunter of the group Beyond Nuclear, who discusses the deal reached to close down Indian Point, one of America's most dangerous nuclear power plants, located just 30 miles north of New York City. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the second time, the government of Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, has sought to shut down Acción Ecológica, one of Latin America's most prominent environmental organizations and rainforest protectors. The latest move by the Ministry of Internal Security came in the aftermath of violence between police, army soldiers, and the indigenous Shuar people, who are opposed to a Chinese-run copper mine, Pananza San Carlos. 2 days before the violence, Acción Ecológica called for a truth commission to investigate the incident with the Shuar people. The move to close Acción Ecológica was condemned by United Nations human rights monitors and social justice activists in Latin America and the United States. On December 20th, the Vice Minister of Internal Security, Diego Torres, accused the environmental activist group of using social media to promote violence against police and security forces. The ministry presented 11 pieces of evidence, including several Facebook posts from Acción Ecológica and several links from the group's website. Acción Ecológica's president, Alexandra Almeida, told The Guardian the evidence lacked any substance. Violence followed the government decision to militarize the region. In August, soldiers forcibly evicted Shuar families and destroyed homes and community buildings. President Obama's executive order, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, gave temporary protection to undocumented immigrant dreamers to get an education, find a job, and most importantly, move out of the shadows. Over 750,000 dreamers who took advantage of DACA are now in limbo as incoming President Trump has pledged to terminate the program. Operating room nurse Jose Aguilas used DACA to obtain a legal driver's license, a work permit, and a social security number. Now, dreamers are fearful of what will happen with the personal information they gave the government to win DACA status. During the final days of the Obama administration, immigration advocates mobilized to pressure the White House to issue pardons to undocumented immigrants. A bipartisan coalition of lawmakers is also pushing the Bridge Act, legislation that would provide a provisional protected presence for law-abiding dreamers, deferring deportations for 3 years and also allowing them to work. During the election campaign, Trump pledged to end DACA and to deport between 2 and 3 million criminal aliens. However, what is unknown is how the Trump administration will define criminality. The government, under the reality TV star billionaire, could target immigrants with simple traffic violations or those who committed misdemeanors as minors. Public sector unions won an unexpected victory in the Friedrich v. California Teachers Association case, when an evenly split U.S. Supreme Court upheld the right of unions to collect agency fees from members it represents in collective bargaining. Before the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, the conservative majority on the High Court appeared ready to overturn the 1977 ruling that gave public sector unions that right. In the end, the court split 4-4 and upheld the right of public unions to collect. According to the news magazine In These Times, a new case may go before the Supreme Court challenging the right of unions to collect agency fees. It involves Illinois' super-wealthy Governor Bruce Rauner, who issued an executive order putting union fees in an escrow account rather than turn it over to public unions. Soon afterwards, a federal judge overruled that order, declaring Governor Rauner did not have legal standing to impound the funds. The new case, Janus v. AFSCME, was dismissed by a district court and is now before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, where it will likely also be rejected. The case could then be appealed to the Supreme Court, which might soon have a new conservative majority if the U.S. Senate moves to confirm a justice nominated by incoming President Donald Trump. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Donald Trump will be sworn in as the 45th president of the United States on January 20th, with the lowest approval rating of any president in recent American history. Questions about Trump's legitimacy have been fueled by U.S. intelligence agencies' conclusion that Russia had launched cyber attacks targeting the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton's campaign in order to hurt the Democratic candidate and boost Trump. Dozens of embarrassing Clinton emails were passed on to WikiLeaks in the closing weeks of the election campaign, which were then published across the U.S. and the world. More than 50 Democratic lawmakers say they won't attend Trump's inauguration to protest Russia's alleged role in his victory and recent insults hurled by the president-elect at civil rights hero Representative John Lewis of Georgia. Trump also enters office under a cloud of suspicion generated by a leaked dossier compiled on the reality TV star turned politician by a former British MI6 intelligence agent, Christopher Steele, who investigated Trump on behalf of his GOP rivals and later by Democrats. The dossier, which has been challenged as fiction by Trump and the Russians, claims that the Kremlin possesses material on Trump's relationship with prostitutes and illicit money deals that could be used in a future blackmail scheme. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and author who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Here, Goodman examines the allegations regarding Russian hacking of the 2016 U.S. election and the contradictory and troubling signals sent by Trump about how he'll steer America's foreign policy.
Well, I think there was no question that Russia had committed itself to the defeat of Hillary Clinton. This was, a personal matter for Vladimir Putin. He blamed Hillary Clinton for interfering in the parliamentary elections in Russia in 2011 and 2012, and he felt that Hillary Clinton's people were responsible for some of the chaotic situation in Ukraine that came on the heels of that. So in terms of Putin's personal involvement, I think he had to give the order to allow this activity to take place because he must have realized at some point there could have been huge consequences in terms of policy and political response. From a policy standpoint and a practical standpoint, Putin probably saw a lot to gain with the election of Donald Trump. I think there's been some exaggeration of the relationship between Putin and Trump. They've never met. I don't think Trump knows a lot about Russia or Russian politics. He probably knows very little of the history of Russian-American relations. He has no institutional memory, but he is someone who has turned aside intelligence briefings. I can't think of a president-elect who needed intelligence briefings more than Donald Trump, but I don't know what context Trump could bring to these briefings to make them comprehensible to him. This is someone with no background in international relations, no great curiosity about international relations. He's not someone who reads. He's not someone who studies. He's not someone who has spoken in any geopolitical or strategic manner. So I don't know what an intelligence briefing could mean for him. So we're starting off as tabula rasa, really. This is going to be a whole new day in relationship toward the Kremlin, which is even more curious by the fact that if you look at the people he's appointed to key positions, particularly the Secretary of State who needs to be confirmed and the Secretary of Defense who needs to be confirmed, they've taken positions that are much different with regard to Putin and with regard to bilateral relations.
Mel, I wondered if you'd comment on the documents that emerged that purport to be a political dossier compiled on Donald Trump by a former British intelligence officer from the MI6 that charges that the Russians have material regarding Trump's relationship with prostitutes and some money deals that could be used in a blackmail scheme somewhere down the line. What kind of credibility do you think this dossier carries with it?
The dossier does not seem credible to me. There's some outlandish charges in there. There's a lot of salacious material in the report. There are misspellings. Individuals have been charged with certain kinds of travel who have then denied that such travel took place, particularly Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, who was not in the Czech Republic, as claimed. So I don't put a lot of weight into this report. I am much more concerned about the attitudes that Trump and his national security advisor, General Flynn, have toward Russia, their lack of understanding of key issues that deal with arms control, that deal with Syria, that deal with the problem in Eastern Europe. And what never gets discussed is the mistakes the United States has made in dealing with Russia, mistakes made by both George W. Bush and, unfortunately, Barack Obama, that have created this terrible situation that exists between Moscow and Washington. And by that I mean the expansion of NATO, the deployment of an anti-missile defense in Poland and Romania, the deployment that continues to this day of NATO forces along the Russian border. All of this is a tremendous act of betrayal, because when we were trying to get the Soviet Union out of East Germany in 1990, right before German reunification, the one thing that James Baker, Secretary of State Baker, and President George H.W. Bush said to Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, their counterparts, is they would not leapfrog over East Germany to go into Eastern Europe. And, of course, that's exactly what Bill Clinton did and then George W. Bush did. And even though Barack Obama has not considered expanding NATO further, Montenegro has now applied for membership with some encouragement from the West. And as I mentioned, we've built up this anti-missile defense, saying that it's against possible targeting of Eastern Europe by Iran. Of course, that never made any sense, but in the wake of the Iranian nuclear accord, it makes no sense whatsoever. So there were a lot of reasons for Putin to say Ukraine is a red line. And given the fact that we were manipulating the Ukrainian situation, and we had the conversations of the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland, in Ukraine, talking to the American ambassador on her cell phone, not exactly protected communications, that confirmed for Putin that we were manipulating the situation. And given his own KGB background, who knew that's what we were doing in the early 1980s in Poland with our support for Solidarność, so those are a lot of reason for Putin to say enough was enough in terms of Western involvement on Russia's border. Why in the world we wanted to take a military alliance such as NATO in the wake of the Soviet collapse and bring it closer to the Russian border at a time of tremendous Russian weakness is something I will never understand. I think that was a huge strategic mistake.
That was Mel Goodman, a former Soviet analyst at the CIA and State Department for 24 years, and an author who currently serves as director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy. For more analysis and commentary on Donald Trump's foreign policy views, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a polarizing presidential election campaign, like few others in U.S. political history, Donald Trump will enter the White House with a majority of Americans disapproving of the erratic real estate billionaire. An ABC News Washington Post poll published on January 17th found that 54% of people surveyed viewed Trump unfavorably, with only 40% viewing him positively. That's the lowest favorability for any incoming president since Jimmy Carter in 1977. The next lowest rated president in previous polls was George W. Bush in 2001, but with a rating 16 points higher than Trump's. Donald Trump's crude rhetoric during the campaign that cast immigrants, Muslims, and other minorities as enemies has many people across the country frightened about what a Trump administration will mean for them and their families. Within hours of Trump's victory on November 8th, through a win in electoral college ballots, but a loss in the popular vote, spontaneous demonstrations against Trump and his agenda erupted across the country. Large protests are planned for the Trump inauguration in Washington and across the nation. The president-elect's campaign pledges that would carry out mass deportations, establish a new government registry for religious minorities, and repeal Obamacare that insures 20 million people has motivated activists from coast to coast to organize self-defense assemblies on the local, regional, and national level. Your reporter spoke with historian, author, and activist Jeremy Brecker, who talks about his recent article titled "Social Self-Defense: Protecting People and Planet Against Trump and Trumpism," that examines the importance of mobilizing a critical mass of citizens in the face of the coming right-wing political assault on multiple fronts.
When I saw what was happening with the creation of networks for protecting immigrants and Muslims and lesbian, gay, and other gender groups, accompanying and providing safety and providing, in the case of immigrants, people all over the country have been organizing to go to the homes of immigrants if they're subject to ICE raids. I saw that, and I thought of this very small beginning of the Polish, it was called KOR. It was originally Worker Self-Defense, and then it became renamed Social Self-Defense. And I thought, that's what we're doing here. We are defending society against the attack of the Trump regime, and we're doing it in myriad different ways, all kinds of different ways. But it started out with individuals and communities and networks that are giving direct support to those who are under attack.
Civil disobedience has always been an important element in progressive social change and the movements that have pushed those forward. Jeremy, what role do you see nonviolent civil disobedience playing here in this coming Trump era?
Well, I think it's already playing a significant role. And I'll just give a couple of examples. The head of the NAACP nationally and a number of others held a occupation of Senator Jeff Sessions' home office and sat in and refused to leave and were arrested several days before the Sessions hearings began. Right after Trump's election, a group of AIDS activists sat in at the office of one of the cabinet nominees of Trump to expose the impact of health care cutbacks and cutbacks of the Affordable Care Act would have on people with AIDS. Fight for 15 strikes, there was a strong component of civil disobedience in those against employers of low-wage workers. So it's already part of it, and I think that we will be looking at many kinds of civil disobedience. Some of them will be occupations and sit-ins. Others will be essentially ways to make it impossible for the Trump agenda to be implemented. So just for example, the sanctuary movements have recruited thousands of people who have agreed to go and have a rapid response network. And when there is a call that an ICE raid is taking place on a family someplace, hundreds of them will go and converge there and engage in nonviolent civil disobedience to protect that family.
I just have one last question here. Over the years, it's been quite apparent that many progressive activist groups are operating independently, and there's not a lot of overlap or cross-endorsement or cross-organizing. Do you see opportunities here with the Trump administration coming in and its hostility to so many currents within the progressive movements across the United States that it could be a catalyst to bring progressives, the left, together in some kind of unified front so that they would act with some more cohesion than they have in the past, as opposed to the kind of silo-like organizing that we've seen over many decades?
That's absolutely crucial. And it's really the function of that idea or slogan of social self-defense is a way of defining the issues about, yes, we're fighting racism, yes, we're fighting sexism, yes, we're fighting for an environment and a climate that is possible to have a future life for all people and our kids and posterity. We're fighting for all those things. Those, in the case of fighting against Trump, are all one struggle, and they're all defense of the basic needs of society the basic things that make a society possible and make it be something other than just a war of all against all. And you can already see this happening. There was this whole program developed by, it included the NAACP, Greenpeace, communication workers, a wide range of groups that came out with a pledge of united resistance and essentially saying we've got each other's backs and we're going to fight as a unified resistance. There are many other expressions of that, too, that it's very striking with these big assemblies that have been happening in cities, that they just include all of those different kinds of issues and different kinds of groups. So I think that that is at the core of what social self-defense against Trump and Trumpism is really all about.
That was historian, author, and activist Jeremy Brecker, co-founder of the Labor Network for Sustainability. Find a link to Brecker's article, Social Self-Defense, Protecting People and Planet Against Trump and Trumpism, and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant is located on the Hudson River, less than 30 miles north of New York City, posing a threat to the city's 8 million residents and to millions more who live in upstate New York and in western Connecticut. Indian Point provides one quarter of the electricity consumed by New York City and nearby Westchester County. Anti-nuclear activists have been trying to close the aging and accident-prone plant for decades, which many critics have dubbed one of the most dangerous nuclear power plants in America. In recent years, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has also campaigned for Indian Point's closure. Under a deal announced last week with Entergy, Indian Point's owner, two of the remaining operating reactors are now scheduled to close in 2020 and 2021. The company insists it's closing the reactors solely because the cost of producing electricity has been undercut by cheaper fracked natural gas that fuels newer power plants. Entergy's federal licenses were scheduled to expire in 2013 and 2015, but the company had been seeking six-year extensions for the two reactors instead of the normal 20-year extension. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Paul Gunter, director of the Reactor Oversight Project at the group Beyond Nuclear, who discusses the great strides that have been made in production of renewable energy that will replace the power lost when Indian Point shuts down. He also explains why he disagrees with the position of climate scientist Dr. James Hansen, who supports nuclear power because it doesn't directly produce greenhouse gases.
Governor Cuomo's plan to replace Indian Point with renewable energy is a model that we should be moving to for the entire country. Right now, we have no offshore wind to speak of in the United States. What Governor Cuomo's plan is to bring 2.4 gigawatts of deep water offshore wind to the state, starting off with 30 megawatts offshore of Block Island, New York, and 90 megawatts offshore of Montauk, and eventually 800 megawatts of offshore wind south of Rockaway Point, New York. And then by 2030, to have over 2,000 megawatts of offshore wind. This would be complementing a plan to bring 2,000 megawatts of solar photovoltaic by 2020. And right now, some of the most advanced energy storage to the state by 2020 as well. You know, the problem is that the state of New York is sending mixed messages by this bailout of the four nuclear power units in upstate New York near Oswego, New York, where, you know, some of the most dangerous reactors designs in the world have been given a cash bailout.
Paul Gunter, Indian Point currently provides a quarter of all the power used in New York City and Westchester County. And while Cuomo may have plans for all this renewable energy, it may not be online before the nuke plant closure dates. The criticism is that renewables are not baseload power. that baseload is either nuclear or fossil fuels. So it seems like there's room for some concern here.
I don't think that's really the case. The plan for New York is already for a seamless transition with the shutdown of Indian Point 2 and 3, that the power would be replaced by hydro power coming in from Canada. So the lights are not even going to flicker for New York, and already there's a lot of reserve energy being generated. This is exactly what I'm interested in conveying to your listeners, is that renewable energy is already making a big difference in power for the United States. In 2015, solar power was already outpacing fossil fuels here in the United States. So new capacity being generated by photovoltaics was already greater than even natural gas.
Dr. James Hansen, who has been the most outspoken climate scientist on the need to transition off fossil fuels, is a supporter of nuclear energy, especially what I guess are called the fourth generation models, which are supposed to be safer than the existing plants.
When he addresses fourth generation nuclear power plants, nobody's really building those kinds of reactors because they're basically still designed. It's ironic that Dr. Hansen would be urging the country to make energy decisions on what really constitutes a technology that's not readily available. And by all demonstrated history, nuclear power is not deliverable, you know, in the time frame that he's claiming that we're going to need it. You know, he's talking about, you know, needing nuclear power generation online within a decade. The last nuclear power plant to come online here in the United States took 43 years to build. And it's also the most costly way of generating heat for boiling water to make electricity. So why would we continue to chase the nuclear mirage when photovoltaics, wind, advanced energy storage are already available?
That was Paul Gunter of the group Beyond Nuclear. Learn more about the long campaign to close down the Indian Point nuclear power plant by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.